How about a little more love and existentialism today?
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
We started out a discussion of Hannah Arendt and her Love and St. Augustine work, which is built off of her dissertation, and an explanation also of using primarily Augustine's Confessions, but a few references to the City of God as well, to just give an underpinning or a foundation to what I really want to start getting to today, which are some applications that come out of her reading of Augustine. Again, this is not really Augustinian. It's Hannah Arendt and her perspective. And it's not even quite just Hannah Arendt. It's my reading of Hannah Arendt reading Augustine and how it impacted me and the things that it's influenced in my understanding of how to explain these principal issues. So if we pick it up where I think we need to, we just have to clarify the thing to be resolved. So the thing we're trying to resolve, the tension that exists, that Augustine is wrestling with in his world, and that Arendt is wrestling with in her world, that we're then trying to bring into our world and say, how do we live out our Christianity here? The thing to be resolved is how to live in a society with Augustine's kind of love. And really what I mean by that is caritas. So, or agape, if we were to say it in Greek, but the kind of Christian love that we think of is self-sacrificing love in Christ, you know, that kind of love, the thing that makes Christianity distinctive and the way its love is realized distinctive. How do we live in a society with that kind of love, or Augustine's kind of love, when there's so much political instability and just outright unlovable behavior, things that ought to be prophetically rejected and so on, or things that ought to be corrected through other behaviors, whatever it is? How on earth do you live out that kind of love in this kind of society? And if you think I'm asking that question because we have so much political instability, I'm not. I'm asking it specifically in the context of Hannah Arendt's world. And she's not asking it specifically in the context of post-World War II Germany and France and America, or even in the context of the full bore of the Holocaust. Because when she starts writing this work, it's before the Holocaust has been realized or Hitler has achieved his power. So the whole nature of it is fundamental all the way back to Augustine asking the question during the Roman times when he's living in a Carthaginian-influenced area of North Africa and so on. And he lives in Rome too and all that kind of stuff, I know, but that's the point, that he's got to figure out how we're supposed to live out this kind of love. And to put it in Hannah Arendt's context for why this would be such a difficult question to answer, and again, I'm personally convicted that it takes somebody like her to get us to think about some of these things, because we don't necessarily, as Christians, think about them as thoroughly as we ought to, based on the obligation that goes with our faith. Sometimes a person from the outside can see what's wrong with our overall perspective better than we ourselves can. And I don't know how to think of where that puts her personally in her relationship with Christianity overall, but I know where it puts me. It puts me looking at my Christianity and wondering, if I'm doing it well enough, and wondering if I'm explaining it well enough to help others be more faithful in their following of Christ. And so that's what I'm trying to do with it. So if we put it in her context, you know, how is this Augustinian love supposed to be lived out in this kind of world? Think about the tension that she experienced. Think about the political instability that she experienced, the hostility that she experienced in her own world. And I'll just give what I think is the most telling sign of the persistence of that animosity in the world for her and for so many other people, and certainly for the Jewish people. So one is, she personally goes from studying with this brilliant mind that she has with the world's greatest philosophers of the day, who are transforming the way everyone is thinking about philosophy. She goes from that in a matter of just a few short years to fleeing Germany because of the Holocaust, obviously, but Kristallnacht and all of the things leading to this anti-Semitism that was taking such a virulent form. She has to flee Germany, and then she goes to France, and then ends up having to flee France because of the persecution that's happening there for her own safety, just to be able to survive in that world. And she's thinking not just, wow, how do I get back at these people, or how do I preserve my own interest here? She's thinking, how do I address mentally, intellectually, but also in writing, so other people can think through it as well, how do I address how people are supposed to live in peace in a world that doesn't want us to be at peace? How are people supposed to live expressing love and desire for the good of other people in a world that seems to perpetrate nothing but violence and hostility against people who are other than themselves? How do we do that? That's what she thinks to ask when she has the opportunity. And so as she moves to America, I mean, here's America, which we love for the reason that it allows for all these different perspectives. It is a promoter of personal freedom. And so in this world, surely in America, she can experience what she's been hunting for the rest of her life, or at least not able to find the rest of her life. But in America, when she comes here, this brilliant scholar with a well-respected reputation, building not only a reputation in the purely intellectual world, but outside of that world, with people recognizing how profound an influence she's having. So she's got some fame and some credit in the country, in America at the time, and she's teaching in the best institutions in the country, you know. She encounters here in the 1950s and 60s the same kind of marauding witch hunts and alienation that she was experiencing in Germany. But here it takes on the form of the Red Scare, of McCarthyism, which ought to concern all of us who are hearing people even now throw around the word Marxist like it's a way of just discarding people. That's a bunch of Marxist nonsense. That's a bunch of Marxist ideology. When you hear that, you ought to just go back and watch anything from the 1950s and all the McCarthyistic Red Scare era. Anyway, she comes to the United States, and fleeing all of this persecution of ideologies and individuals in Europe, she comes to America where it's free, and instead experiences, because she's married to Heinrich Blücher, who was a founding member of the German Communist Party back in the day. Not anymore, but back in the day, he was that, right? So back in the 20s and 30s, he's founding the German Communist Party, which is a party specifically opposed to Stalinism, to the totalitarianism of the communist government in the Soviet Union at the time. He is all of that. I'm not for being that, but that's his background. He's not that anymore. He's in the United States with Hannah Arendt, and he's not that anymore. But there is this bill that was passed back in 1952, got through Congress, the McCarran-Walter Act of 1952, which allowed for, and, you know, these things just make you put SMH in your text messages, don't they? Shake my head, right? They make us shake our heads. In 1952, we're passing legislation that allows for the legal deportation of naturalized citizens. Naturalized citizens can be deported, or the residents, obviously, can be deported if they had ever been members of a totalitarian political party or state. That whole time period, I mean, we look back on it with embarrassment, but the very same influences are at work in a lot of cases today. We can't get out of it. It's always going to reemerge, and there's a reemergence of evils on every side, on the left, on the right. They're always coming back. But you can sort of identify with what she was going through, because now, for years, I'm saying now in the 1950s and 60s, after she's been through all the horrendous harassment of anti-Semitism in Germany and France, and then come to America, she finds that she's in a perpetual, for over a decade, in this perpetual anxiety about the deportation of her and her husband because of a political party he had been a part of decades before. That's where she's living. In that world, she doesn't take up rants and protests to just, you know, antagonize everyone. I'm not saying she didn't participate in any protests, but that's not her method. Her method is to ask not even just questions about how to write the right book to undermine the American government. She doesn't do any of that. She wants to finish this book, detail it out, edit it, and get it into something that could make a difference. A book about how to say, in that kind of world, how are we supposed to live out the kind of love that Augustine said we're supposed to have as he is a follower of Christ? How are we supposed to do that? That seems like a pretty good question for us to have to resolve. And so I want to frame that question for us and try to, you know, address how we ought to think about it. I think it'll take probably today and next time for us to finish the discussion. So one way to frame the problem to be solved would be like this. I'm going to have to give this in two versions. So we're going to create the problem by saying, here's one way we think about living out our faith in the world. And then I want to create the alternative. So this first way is going to take a minute for description. So here's a standard way. We can call it the standard way. It is a way that I like. I can advocate for this. I don't think there's anything wrong with what I'm about to describe. I don't think it fulfills Christianity, but it's not against Christianity. There's room for Christianity in a world where people are living this out. So I advocate for it. What I'm about to give you is a very libertarian kind of description of our engagement in the world. So here's a way to frame solving the problem, sort of, I'm going to call it the standard way for a conservative Christian in 21st century America, and certainly at the end of 20th century America, to describe living out our faith in this social and political context, where we have this kind of economy and this kind of government and these kinds of liberties and rights and so on. So here's the way I would take it. God commands us to love. That's the first step. This is easy. That follows right along the lines of Augustine, right? So now the question is, how do we live out that love? Well, we don't often think of it in terms of love, but let me just follow the libertarian path and end up at the place where we could say, so see, I'm actually loving my neighbor by doing this. So here's the command to love in a world of scarce resources. We're in a world where some people have access to some things and other people have access to other things, and none of us has access to everything, and everyone fails to have access to some things, right? Scarce resources. There are not enough houses for every single person to have a mansion that they live in. There's not enough space in, you know, Dallas for every single person to have as much yard space as they would like to have for their ducks and chickens and goats and stuff. So everybody has to sort of give in and put up a fence and have a smaller house or put a giant house on a very tiny lot right next to people who don't want that house. Well, you get the idea. Anyway, we live in a world of scarce resources. In that world, though, we also have a God who gave us all varying talents and skills for using those resources. So I might have the ability to take a resource and use it in a way that benefits more people than somebody else would do using the same resource. Maybe I'm better at the academic stuff, and so here I am in a college. Maybe I'm better at plumbing than somebody else, and so here I am running a plumbing company. Maybe I'm better as an entrepreneur, and so here I am building a financial empire on the back of business, you know, and stuff like that. Whatever it is that I'm better at, I'm doing, and odds are I'm able to do it, and I'm able to support myself doing it because I do it better than some other people might be doing it with the same resources. And the idea of that is that if we're all varied in the talents and skills that we're bringing to the table, then cooperation is benefiting everyone. And I mean, that goes all the way back to Plato. I do better if I'm able to focus on cobbling shoes while you're making, you know, producing grain from the ground because you're better at farming and I'm better at cobbling. So we cooperate together and you get better shoes and I get more food and everybody's happy and so on. All that kind of cooperation benefits everyone. It just makes sense. So we exchange things like that. And in that context, work, when I'm making shoes or when you're farming the ground, in Plato's example, it benefits everyone. And that's the exercise of our dominion over the world, too. That component is largely Catholic reading of it. You hear it a lot if you've ever heard of the Acton Institute and their sort of way of approaching it. And I think it's a reasonable argument. I mean, I'm not even criticizing the argument. I'm not criticizing any of this. I actually align with a lot of these ideas in the natural sense. So work benefits everyone. The more I work, the more I'm doing what God created me to do, which is exercise dominion over the world, create order out of the disorder, or be able to tend to the things of the ground that God produces and so on. So work benefits me, but it also benefits everyone else because now I'm taking natural resources and turning them into something that can benefit all of the people around me. And so the economy grows as the amount of work grows, and then everybody prospers more. And I actually agree with all of that. I love it. I love to have a growing and flourishing economy built on the idea that people are freely working in the ways that they're best at and probably most interested in because they're best at it. I love all of that idea. And so what comes out of that would be ideally, and, you know, it's a very libertarian approach. I know, I'm admitting it. I have a bias in this direction. And this isn't even where I'm going to end up. I'm going somewhere else. But in this bias, you should know, it is going to work best if government will interfere least. If we allow people to focus on the things they want to focus on, they can really flourish in their own production and therefore for the benefit of the whole society. So I need government to, you know, that government is best in Thomas Jefferson's words, which governs least. So I'm all in favor of that kind of stuff. I like that idea. So here is what would come out of that. The fulfillment of God's will on earth could be seen as human flourishing on earth. The command to multiply and fill the earth, and I have given you every plant of the field and every animal, all those kinds of statements sort of fit that idea of us fulfilling God's will as we flourish in the work that we do in the world. So a society, all of this is in that sort of standard model that I'm trying to describe for you. So a society where people are able to work and contribute to the economy is a fulfillment of God's will on earth. Voila, we're fulfilling the very nature of what Scripture reveals for us just by working hard and supporting each other in society. And the nature of exchange would mean, in a free market, that everyone gets to express and receive actually, and this is, now this part I'm not going to find satisfactory, but I'm going to say there's a reasonable argument to be made here to receive love through work. So if you think about it in terms of the nature of financial or economic exchanges, the cost of something in an exchange is always less than the value of that thing for the person who's purchasing it. Otherwise, they wouldn't make the purchase. I'm not going to give you $10 when cash is maximally fluid for my benefit. I'm not going to give you my $10 in cash if the thing you're giving me isn't worth more than $10 in whatever narrow use I have in mind for it. I would just keep the $10 otherwise, which means that where we're making those kinds of exchanges, when I sell someone my work or my product, it's worth more to them than what they paid. And what they paid is worth more to me than that product was to me. That's why I sold it to them and took the $10 from them. Oh, we're just all loving up on each other up in here, you know? I'm giving you a product, you're giving me 10 bucks, and I got something worth more than that product was, the 10 bucks, and you got something worth more than 10 bucks to you, that product. And it all happened because we just worked and served each other in the process. And lo and behold, our love for each other is our service to each other. And the whole world is better because we're just working and producing all of this flourishing in human society. What a beautiful way to express Christ's love. So I understand the argument for that. I've made the argument for it in the past. But there is a problem with thinking that, I find that model of an economy beautiful. I wish we could always be there. I realize that there are limitations on that. For other days and other discussions, we can talk about why there may need to be more government rather than less government, and why all those kinds of things, the limitations that come on a libertarian view of what a society could be. I understand it's fraught with all kinds of challenges. That's not the point for today. If I just take a libertarian approach, I've got this model of love being demonstrated in the world simply by working and prospering with each other and producing a society of interdependence where everybody benefits and is blessed and is growing and is doing for others more than what they are getting from the other in the other person's mind. That's all fine. There is a problem with that model of an economy as the fulfillment of Christianity on earth. This is different because, you know, the world's fallen. Christianity is about the redemption of the world and the redemption of mankind. Is there something more to the redemption of the world than simply restoring it to the place where we're all flourishing in a working free economy, you know, that kind of idea? And I think there is, inherently, for reasons that happen to come up in Hannah Arendt's work about Augustine. And this is related to the pondus meum amor meus, you know, to the idea that the statement is my love is my weight. But we should take it more. I think the metaphor communicates better if you say my love is my gravity. The thing I love is the thing that pulls me toward it, right? That's what drives me or motivates me to be what I am and to do what I do. Okay, so for us to consider the tension here, we've described sort of the libertarian model and how you could take that as a fulfillment of the love of Christ on earth because we're flourishing in our work, blah, blah, blah. Let me give the opposite of that now. Let me give the tension that's created. If we recognize this, we might have to realize something different in the world for us to fulfill the love that Christ wants us to have, the caritas that he wants us to have. And honestly, in reading this book by Arendt, it's the first time that I've really had an understanding of how different this is. And I should have picked it up from Augustine as well, but I think her processing it through him makes more sense to me. So, and for reasons that I'll communicate probably in the third show that we'll do, in the next show that we'll do, about the nature of our existence as agents in the world. So anyway, to get there, the contrast would be something like this. And this is recognizing that there's a problem with thinking that that beautiful model of an economy is the fulfillment of Christianity on earth. So consider this, the statement, I'll give it, is the basis of social interdependency. So if the way we depend on each other is our need for products from each other, I depend on society and I exist within society for the benefit that I get from society, when I take that perspective, which is a very Hobbesian perspective, Thomas Hobbes, you know, the philosopher. We've talked about Plato last time. You can listen to the previous episode and catch up on all of that stuff. Sort of the opposite of that is a Thomas Hobbes, who, as an empiricist, just describes the world the way it happens to emerge, the way we see it emerge in our experience. And in Hobbes's world, you know, everything emerges because people begin their lives as creatures that want to avoid pain and pursue pleasure. And as we do that, in our selfish interest, we develop very sophisticated understandings of where that pleasure could be maximized, which includes a society, which includes yielding to authorities in some cases and to commitments, promises in other cases, that might actually cause me some pain. But ultimately, being a member of that society is worth so much. This is his social contract theory in a nutshell. Is worth so much to me, that pleasure that I get from being a part of that society is so valuable to me that it's worth the cost of those minor or momentary pains, even if, by the way, they end up costing me my life. The society is worth exactly that much. So if we see the world in Hobbes's way, that social interdependency is the basis that we have for living and functioning within society, then that's not going to be enough to explain what it would mean to love like Christ calls us to love. It wouldn't accomplish the same thing for this reason. Because now here's the thing. Christ doesn't call us away from serving one another and society. Obviously, we're called to serve in society. But equating that service with nothing more than what we do when we're working for the gain that we get from the work, while we're making an even greater gain for them from their perspective, it doesn't take out the benefit that it brings to us. So in one sense, obviously, Christ doesn't call us away from serving one another in society, but in another sense, he does call us beyond that to serve more than in the way the average person, the normal person, and by that, I mean the person who doesn't serve Christ. I'm not saying they're evil or wicked. All of us without Christ are wicked in that sense, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, as far as moral behaviors, plenty of non-Christ followers are doing plenty of moral things and would compare very favorably with the finest Christians I know. I don't have any problem saying all of that. It doesn't change this, that if I only see serving in society for the things it brings to me, I'm not seeing the full sense of what Christ commands us to do in our service. He calls us beyond the kind of service we simply have for each other. Take, for example, Paul's expression of it in Colossians. Bond servants, so here we are working for someone. We've committed ourselves to them for a certain period of time in order to pay off a debt or whatever it is. So bond servants, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service, as if you were just pleasing people, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. That's a change in the gravity of our lives, that the thing we love is Christ, and therefore the thing that motivates us to serve is Christ, not what we get from the other person. Interdependency would motivate us to get from the other person so that we can go and buy our supper and make some more products that we give to other people and makes us a valuable and loved part of society and a part of society where we love one another as brothers, we love one another as fellow patriots, we love one another as fellow citizens, and we serve one another in all of those ways, but we're not drawn by Christ. We're drawn by our interdependency. We're drawn by that relationship we have in the economy. That's not the same thing. And if Christ calls us beyond that, then we might need to think about what it is that Christ is calling us to that's beyond it. Another expression of it on the negative side is we don't get to do the service that Christ calls us to in order to get from society anything that we want. Anything. And I mean the basics, even a place to live. And I'm taking this from Jesus' own words, you know, as Luke records them for us in Luke 9. As they were going along the road, someone says to him, "Hey, I'll follow you wherever you go. I'm going to be a follower of Jesus." Okay, well, we know what that means. He's got one great command. If we're going to follow Jesus, we have to obey his commands. If we're going to love Jesus, we have to obey his commands. He's got one great command, love your neighbor as yourself. So we got to learn to love the way Jesus wants us to love. We know underlying anything it means to follow Jesus is going to be that. So what does he say to the person who says to him, "I'll follow you wherever you go"? Jesus said to him, Foxes have holes. Birds of the air, they have nests. But the Son of Man doesn't even have anywhere to lay his head. To another person, he says, you, how about you follow me? But that person responded and said, well, you know, I've got these obligations here. I have service I have to do within my family. Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, leave the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim the kingdom of God. And another says, hey, I'll follow you. But Lord, first, let me say farewell to those who are at my home. Just let me say goodbye to the people who are at my home. Jesus says to him, no one puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. If we only love our neighbor because we love Christ, then the argument is we're no longer only loving for the interdependency that comes with social necessity. I exist as part of this society. I have to contribute my part to the society. And by doing that, I benefit the society. And we all love one another. And we experience the fruition, the fulfillment of God's creation on earth. Maybe. But not of Christ's redemptive work on earth. And that's what Caritas is about. That's what his love, instituted through us, is supposed to be about. If you were, to use the word institute, if you were to put this in institutional terms, it's why Christian organizations fit best in the category of nonprofit. And I'm not talking as a tax person here. I barely survive in the world of taxes and accounting and all that stuff. That's not my world. I depend on so many other people in order to understand all of that world and to live in it. I'm not even pretending I couldn't grasp it intellectually. I love math. I love all the stuff that goes with it. But I just can't live in that world without getting sucked completely into it. So I'm really grateful for the people who save my life by helping me with it. I'm thankful for that. But here's what I mean by saying Christian organizations, institutions, ought to be in the category of nonprofit. And of course, churches are. So are Christian hospitals. But so are non-Christian hospitals. Now, I know there are for-profit hospitals. But I mean, there are a ton of organizations that call themselves nonprofit. What I mean is there ought to be in the Christian world institutions which exist as this radical agent within the economy, completely independent of what it would mean for them to make money or not make money as a result of what they're doing. This is why the world of charitable giving is called the world of charitable giving. You give to organizations that don't exist to produce something that's worth so much to the society economically that they can make their own money to support their enterprise. Instead, they're so committed to introducing into the world, now I'm going to put this in Christian terms, they're so committed to introducing into the world something that only Christ wants to be in that world, even if it is a pure expression of love, a straightforward expression of love, like churches preaching the gospel, for instance. Even if it's just that simple, that church depends on the charitable giving of its members or of the people in the community. A school like ours depends on people who have produced and served and benefited the society so much that they have resources they can turn around and give to someone like a school like this or a church or a hospital or whatever it is and say, continue serving the community, not out of what you're going to get for it, but because you want to serve Christ. You keep doing that. That's a completely different kind of institution. And again, there are all kinds of not-for-profit organizations that actually are for-profit organizations. I'm not complaining about the tax code. I'm not complaining about the IRS. I'm not complaining about their legitimacy and what they contribute to the world. I'm saying my point is not the language of being not-for-profit. My point is literally that you have to choose not to serve, as Peter says it to pastors, for the sake of the gain that comes from it. You can't do that. That's not what it means for us to demonstrate the love of Christ, which means there's something different between the love that we ought to be able to express to others in this world, where everyone can express service to each other in simple work product. Let's just make stuff that benefits the economy and benefits the people around us and be faithful in our stewardship of the resources God has given us in the world and create an interdependency in this society that's beautiful and flourishing and so on. all of that can be beautiful, and it's still not caritas. It is still not loving the way Christ loved us, which is without regard to what we get back from it. That makes this different. To put it back in terms of the statement, my love is my weight, or my love is my gravity, it would be like this. No matter how productive I am, no matter how valuable my contribution to society is, if my motivation is what I'm getting from it, if my motivation is, look what I've been able to produce for society, I don't mean that selfishly. Like, I just want money out of this. If my motivation is, look, I have produced something so worthwhile for this society that I'm able to have a sustainable life here. They view it as so valuable, they're giving me the things I need in order for me to keep producing that for them and to have enough to live my own life. If that's my motivation, what I'm getting from it, then the gravity of my whole existence is still myself. I'm still Hobbesian. Which is not, I'm not even saying that's evil. I can be motivated for myself in such a way that I maximize my benefit to everyone else and I harm no one. That's a beautiful participation in the economy. I hope for that from so many people. That's what we want to be. That's fine. But if that's my motivation, it is still my own motivation. If I love Christ, and I follow his example. If I love Christ and I want to be following his example, then I realize, I have to realize this. He says it repeatedly in terms of a cross, in terms of being rejected by your own family, in so many different ways. He makes this point. You can't follow me if you don't lose your own life and choose to take up your cross. Then you can follow me if you don't deny yourself. All of that language is making this point. That what we ought to realize is that if we're going to live this out for Christ, if our love is for him and we're going to follow his example, then we have to realize there's no price too great to pay if my life can serve his interest, Christ's interest, or someone else's interest. If I can serve him or the people he's put me into this world to serve, then the gravity of my life is toward Christ, not just toward myself. And this relates to so many different things that we'll introduce, and I will begin them today, but we won't finish them today at all. But you'll get why this is so compelling for me to be able to talk about. Because related to this, this understanding of what it means to love, that you have to love Christ, and by loving Christ, be able to express that selflessly towards others, not for what you're going to get from them, not because it makes you an interdependent part of this healthy society, even though it can still do that. It could still do that, but it can't be your motive. This understanding demands a belief in a couple of things. Well, I mean, frankly, they're part of what makes me such a fan of Hannah Arendt. They are. I didn't even realize it. You know, I read her for years and was appreciating what she said before I read anything that made clear that she actually held these views that are so fundamental to my understanding of the world as well. And then it's like, oh, well, no wonder I'm really enjoying this. She's got built into the foundation of her thinking things that are pre-foundational to my thinking. It resonates with me. And what am I talking about? Number one, you have to believe in the possibility of genuine altruism. You can't pursue caritas the way Augustine talks about it, or the way Hannah Arendt talks about Augustine talking about it, if you don't believe in the possibility of genuine altruism. And if you don't know altruism, it's just the opposite of egoism. In egoism, I inherently serve my own interest. In altruism, I serve the interest of others, legitimately others, not others because of what it gives me. I legitimately serve the interest of others. There are all kinds of caveats in there. My listeners who don't believe in legitimate altruism or genuine altruism, meaning of actual ontological altruism, my listeners who don't believe in that are saying to themselves right now, well, I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. Even if you choose altruism, you're still the person choosing altruism. And so it's your ego that's choosing the altruism. It's just a different form of egoism. It doesn't make it not valid. It just makes, you know, whatever. And I understand why you would say that. It's a very reasonable argument, despite the mocking voice I gave to it a moment ago, which I apologize for. The point is, not deep apology, because it wasn't that mocking. Anyway, the point is, I recognize, I respect what you're saying. I understand where it comes from, but altruism itself needs to have some legitimate form if this kind of caritas is going to be realized, for reasons, again, that I'll talk about in the next episode. We're going to get into it in more detail, but it is fundamental to our understanding of the world. And this is one of the most difficult and basic questions that ethicists have to answer, and that over the last 100 years, even in terms of evolutionary biology, that biologists have been trying to answer. How do you account for altruism? And in their model, most of the time, not all the time, but almost all the time, they're just looking for how you explain all the different forms that altruism takes, ultimately in terms of some kind of egoism, either individualistically or tribally or species-wise or whatever it might be. We got to find some way to have altruism. I've talked about that before when we talked about George Price. Another day, another episode. Anyway, the next thing is, there are two things I said. One, you have to believe in the possibility of genuine altruism. And secondly, you have to believe it's somehow possible for human beings to act contrary to all of nature's impulse for us to serve our self-interest. Now, I'm a person who believes in a radical free will. It's fundamental to my understanding of the world. I appreciate and understand the arguments of those who disagree with me, who do not believe that a radical free will is possible. I also appreciate and understand those of you who are saying right now, what's a radical free will? What are you talking about? I understand why you would ask that question. Believe me, I'll be happy to explain it. I love talking about the details of that question. But those two items show up in spades in Hannah Arendt's reading of Augustine. And they are fundamental to what she comes down to in this statement, in this, not just a statement, but in this idea that's conveyed, that simple interdependency, the simple workflow of living in the world and thriving in it and therefore producing a thriving society of interdependent people, none of that can realize what Christ demonstrates when he teaches us about caritas, when he teaches us about charity, when he teaches us about agape, when he teaches us about selfless or divine love. If we're going to have the kind of love that Christ had for us, the kind of love that God had for us, then I think we're going to have to answer some questions about altruism and a radical free will that we might otherwise have tried to avoid or tried to explain away into something that I think is helpful, like a libertarian economy, but not fulfilling of what Christ has called us to. I think he's called us to more. So, next time, more.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.